Welcome friends to Literature Mantra. I'm Harsh Singh. In this lecture, we will discuss eco-criticism. Eco-criticism is a very recent mode of criticism and it is one of the newest additions to critical theory. So in this session, what are the things that we will take up? First, what exactly is eco-criticism? Second, why was there even a need for this kind of criticism or this kind of approach towards literary studies? Then what does eco-criticism seek to do or seek to achieve? After that, how and when it started and what are the varieties within or variants within eco-criticism? One is the US version, the other is the UK version. And after that, what are the premises or assumptions which are common to both these varieties, the US variety as well as the UK variety? After that, what are the similarities between eco-criticism and other modes of literary criticism or literary theory or critical theory? For example, how would we judge eco-criticism vis-a-vis structuralism, then post-structuralism, then deconstruction, and then finally some works and authors important from the point of view of eco-criticism? Now, if we start with the definition given by Cheryl Glotfelty, I quote, "Simply defined, eco-criticism is the study of the relationship between literature and the physical environment," unquote. After that, what was the need to even formulate a new kind of criticism? Already we had so many other modes of critical theory and literary criticism. So why was there even a need? Now, as the name suggests, eco-criticism. So it has something to do with ecology and environment and nature. Eco-criticism debates nature in order to defend nature. And eco-critics seek to make nature central to critical thinking and practice. There is a belief within eco-criticism that the present method in which human beings are exploiting nature is not sustainable. And this became even more evident in the mid-1980s when there was the discovery of the hole in the ozone layer over the Antarctic. So along with this and the insights of many authors and writers which help people understand the damage which we are doing to nature in the name of industrialization or urbanization and the fact that very soon it will become unsustainable. Because of all of this, eco-criticism finally arose as a unique and distinct mode of critical theory. And see, eco-criticism is not limited to the realm of literary studies or just to literature. Eco-criticism can be said to be the literary dimension, but it also has other dimensions, the political dimension, for instance. And the political dimension is seen when we have numerous international agreements on environment protection, for instance, agreement on climate change. Then there is the Vienna Convention for Protection of the Ozone Layer. Then there is a UN Convention to Combat Soil Desertification. Then there is a Convention on Biological Diversity. Then there are various UN conventions on protection of marine life and ecosystems, and probably many other things related to the protection of the environment. So that is the political dimension or political manifestation where action is needed. But even before action is taken, there should be some kind of consciousness generation or generation of consciousness amongst people. So in the field of literary studies, eco-criticism seeks to do this. And of course, in doing this, it uses environmental ethics, analyze literature by taking up the works of many writers, for example, British Romantics or writers during the American Transcendentalism, such as Emerson, Margaret Fuller, then Henry David Thoreau. After that, let's discuss some assumptions in eco-criticism. One is that our normal mode of functioning is based on anthropocentrism, and then there is something called speciesism. Anthropocentrism is basically a belief that human beings are the central and most important entity of the world, and this type of belief leads automatically to a species hierarchy or creating a kind of hierarchy within species, which is then called speciesism, which can be defined as the practice of treating members of one species as morally more important than members of other species. And the term speciesism was introduced by the English philosopher Richard Hyder in the 1970s. And subsequently, it was popularized by the Australian philosopher Peter Singer. Okay, Peter Singer and Richard Hyder. And as I said, since our normal mode of functioning is based on anthropocentrism, which is the belief that human beings are the central and most important entity of the world, anthropocentrism also regards human beings not just central but also superior to nature, and holds that human life has intrinsic value while other entities including plants, animals, mineral resources and so on, they can justifiably be exploited for the benefit of humankind. And you might have even come across many scriptural descriptions where man is said to be created in the image of God, and that man has dominion over entire earth, and that all other creatures, non-living, living creatures, are there to serve man. So when our thinking is based on this principle that we are the supreme beings or central or most important living beings, which is what anthropocentrism is, then it will lead to disrespect for other living beings, living or non-living beings on earth, and consequently we might end up exploiting them because we already know that they are there to serve our interests. So why not exploit them? So eco-criticism is against these two things. One is anthropocentrism and the other is speciesism. And instead of having an exploitative kind of relationship, eco-criticism wants there to be a symbiotic relationship between different organisms on this planet. So in a way, trying to say that each organism or each living or non-living being has its own place, its own importance, without anybody or anyone being subservient to somebody else. Now, before the advent of eco-criticism, there was an absence of an ecological approach in literary studies or in literary theory. Or in critical theory, there was no such approach. So it was important to bring in such an approach, considering that the ecological or environmental dimension has its own importance. And it started in the 1990s with Cheryl Glotfelty's book called The Eco-Criticism Reader, Landmarks in Literary Ecology. This is the complete title of her book. And there is also the UK version of eco-criticism, and Jonathan Bate is considered to be the one who started this, and particularly his work called The Romantic Ecology, Wordsworth and the Environmental Tradition. This is the title of Jonathan Bate's work. Romantic Ecology, Wordsworth and the Environmental Tradition. And this book basically drew on the ideas of the English Romantic poets, or English Romanticism in general. Whereas the US version, or the US variety, drew on the ideas of Transcendentalism. So the works of Thoreau, Emerson became important. And in her work, The Eco-Criticism Reader, Cheryl Glotfelty says that establishing nature as an essential referent of contemporary critical theory was important. Now, let's discuss some more premises and assumptions within eco-criticism, be it in the UK version or the US version. Now, along with the basic trait of eco-criticism, which we have already discussed, there is also always a critique of binaries. For example, nature and culture, man and woman. Because as we will discuss in this lecture, there is something called eco-feminism. And eco-feminism stresses that the way man has exploited nature by continuously feminizing nature or giving nature attributes of women, similar is man's exploitation of women. And this is because man has created a binary of man versus woman, nature versus culture. So by giving feminine qualities to nature, or by ascribing feminine qualities to nature, man exploits nature. So eco-critics are against this construction of binaries. And within the literary canon, there is a focus that we should recover works of nature writers. Of course, Wordsworth and his romantic contemporaries are always included. But writers like John Clare, which find mention nowadays, earlier, you know, some decades back, they were not even mentioned, or somehow glossed over, or wherever mentioned, they were treated as minor writers. And John Clare is one of those writers whose works have been retrieved and accorded greater importance nowadays in textbooks, specifically on the history of English literature, those textbooks. And one reason is also that his works display or tell us about nature. So this is also one of the basic aims of eco-criticism. In other words, it is one of the premises of eco-criticism to recover some writers' works who have been ignored, particularly those writers who write about nature. After this, the work of eco-critics is not limited to recovering works of writers, but also offering a kind of rereading or interpretation to the old texts or texts already read or studied by us. For example, offering reinterpretations of works of William Wordsworth. After that, eco-critics are against the linguistic construction of nature, or the post-structuralist or structuralist understanding of the world or nature. Because they say that unlike things such as language or culture or identity, which might be driven by or influenced by or shaped by linguistic constructions or cultural practices, the physical world or nature, you know, means in the physical sense, nature in the physical sense, is not just a linguistic construction or a social construction or something that is driven by culture. It is something real, something tangible, and not something limited to our perception or how we think. And famously, as Kate Soper said in her work, What is Nature? It's a famous work by Kate Soper, What is Nature? I quote, "It isn't language which has a hole in its ozone layer," unquote. So nature is not driven by just linguistic construction or social construction. It is real. You know, if there is a hole in the ozone layer, that is real. So with regard to structuralism, post-structuralism and deconstruction, eco-criticism rejects their emphasis on the linguistic construction of different phenomena of the world or of life. So it rejects the social construction or cultural construction. For example, post-structuralism or deconstruction would say that meaning is slippery. No, you can never reach a final meaning. But the thing is, if there is a hole in the ozone layer, that is reality. It is not something that requires more explanation. That is real. It is not just social construction or linguistic construction, na? Now, another related issue is of deep ecology. The central premise of deep ecology can be described as follows, that our worldview, thinking, responses, and action are human-centric, which is technically called, you know, anthropocentrism. But in order to ensure a safer planet, we need to become ecocentric or biocentric. So this is the central premise of deep ecology. Now, deep ecology is not the same as ordinary environmentalism. Now, what is environmentalism? Environmentalism basically is concern for the environment or action that is taken for protecting the environment. So, environmentalism is a broad movement. Let's say it can be considered as an umbrella term for the various environmental movements that are ongoing in the world. It's a broad term. And environmentalism aims at the preservation and restoration of the environment by reducing the impact of human activities on Earth. So coming back to deep ecology is not the only way in which environment was being protected earlier. Environmentalism, as I said, has been a very broad movement to protect the environment. But deep ecology goes a step further. It says that it is not just about protecting the environment. It is also about changing the relationship of human beings with nature. This is what deep ecology says. And rather than taking an instrumentalist view of nature, for example, regarding nature as an instrument for man's development or man's fulfillment or man's growth, nature is considered as having its own intrinsic value and its own worth. Therefore, nature should be respected. And this is what distinguishes deep ecology from other forms of environmentalism or environmental movements. And it asserts that, as I already pointed out, that the present foundation of our thinking with respect to nature, which is anthropocentrism, should be changed to one which is biocentric, okay, one that is based on or rooted in biocentrism, which is respect for other life forms on the planet. And biocentrism also asserts that all life forms deserve moral consideration. It is not just human beings that deserve moral consideration, in the sense that you should take actions, not just from the point of view of human beings, but also from the point of view of the entire planet, which includes living and non-living beings. And two names are specifically important in the field of deep ecology. The first is Ern Neese and the second is George Sessions. Okay, Ern Neese and George Sessions. And these two names are important because they proposed the 8-point platform for deep ecology. There's something called 8-point platform. After this, deep ecology itself is not a single unified movement. It itself is composed of various subgroups. So there are social ecologists, pacifists, eco-feminists. But yes, as it happens with any movement, despite there being disparate or varied subgroups within this larger movement of deep ecology, still there are some common points of agreement between all of them. And as I said, eco-feminism is also one of those subgroups that support deep ecology. And not just that, ecofeminism is also an important branch of feminism. So it is not limited to deep ecology. It is also related to feminism. But what is the uniqueness of ecofeminism? Now, besides having all the components of feminism, besides, let's say, agreeing to all the basic premises of feminism, it also adds few more things. For example, commitment to environment and the awareness of the associations or linkages that are made between women and nature. Why? Because nature most of the times is feminized. You know, there are descriptions like mother nature or virgin land. So eco-feminists are acutely aware of this kind of association. After this, as I said, you know, there is a kind of gendering of nature. Gendering of nature generally takes place because it gives legitimacy for greater control over it and consequent exploitation of nature. For example, if nature is feminized and described as virgin land or mother nature, it means that somehow this virgin land or mother nature needs to be controlled or protected to save it from external force. And also, eco-feminists are against the naturalization of women. They are against the feminization of nature, but also the naturalization of women. Now, what do I mean by naturalization of women? Basically, the idea that being a woman or femininity associated with women is somehow natural. And it is not a linguistic or a social or cultural construct, but a natural construct. So eco-feminists are against the naturalization of women. Because according to feminist theoreticians, woman or man is something not limited to just the body's biology or anatomy, but something which is socially constructed. Now, the ideas associated with femininity or masculinity are socially constructed. So, those are social or cultural constructs. Therefore, eco-feminists are against the naturalization of women. Eco-feminists, therefore, examine the social norms that help men subordinate women to men or women and nature. For instance, the norms that somehow inculcate the idea that nature or land or women need to be protected and that they are safest only under the protection of men. In addition, eco-critics and eco-feminists are against the hierarchization of the natural environment and also the feminization of nature. Now, hierarchization of natural environment means treating different organisms as though they occupy a kind of hierarchy or hierarchy of importance. So, those that are not so important, they can be extinguished or they can be butchered or they can be killed. And those who are more important, for example, human beings are the most important. So, everything should work according to their own requirements and needs. So, if we need animals for food, kill them. So, this is a kind of hierarchization which eco-feminists are against. Instead, eco-critics and eco-feminists want that our attitude or our relationship with nature changes and we drop the idea of nature being a kind of instrument for our needs or for our growth, but respect nature because of its inherent glory or importance or intrinsic worth. Now, another important thing that you should know about are names of some authors and their works in the field of eco-criticism. Now, the first and most important name is of Cheryl Glotfelty, as I already pointed out, and her work, The Eco-Criticism Reader, Landmarks in Literary Ecology. This is the complete title. After that, Jonathan Bate, and Jonathan Bate's work is called Romantic Ecology, Wordsworth and the Environmental Tradition. Then another important work in the field of eco-criticism is of Raymond Williams, The Country and the City. Okay, The Country and the City, this is the title. And another work of Jonathan Bate is The Song of Earth, The Song of the Earth. You know, so, two important works of Jonathan Bate. There is also another work by Joseph W. Meeker. Okay, Joseph W. Meeker, called The Comedy of Survival, Studies in Literary Ecology. Okay, The Comedy of Survival, Studies in Literary Ecology. And in this work, Joseph Meeker coined the phrase literary ecology. Okay, he's the one who coined this phrase, literary ecology. And this book or this work came out in 1972. Another important work is by William Rukert. Okay, William Rukert, which is called Literature and Ecology, An Experiment in Eco-Criticism. Okay, Literature and Ecology, An Experiment in Eco-Criticism. And this book is important because, you know, this is probably the first book where the term eco-criticism was first used. Of course, Cheryl Glotfelty uses this in her work, which was published later on. But this work by William Rukert, which came out in 1978, he uses this, you know, in this work. So eco-criticism was first used in this work. So just remember the name of this book, okay, Literature and Ecology, An Experiment in Eco-Criticism. And of course, as I've already pointed out, two names in the field of deep ecology, George Sessions and Ern Nies. So, from an exam point of view, what are the things that you should keep in mind? First is the origins of
eco-criticism? What was the need for this kind of critical theory? Second, what are the varieties, the two varieties within eco-criticism? One, I told you, it is the American version. The second is the British version. So what is the difference between these two varieties? Afterwards, we also discussed some important writers and their works. And broadly, we also discussed what is the aim of eco-critics. So these are the things that you should definitely keep in mind. After this, in the next part, we will discuss the various waves of eco-criticism. So, agar aapne padha hai feminism, in feminism, there are different waves. First wave, second wave, third wave, and so on. Even in eco-criticism, there are waves. That we will discuss in the next part. Afterwards, we will also discuss some more theorists and also their ideas. Along with this, we will also discuss what are the type of MCQs that are generally there in exam from eco-criticism. Okay? And along with all of this, we will also discuss little bit more on what exactly eco-critics do when they analyze literary works. Okay?